Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Yikes, the Dow takes a dive. How inequality hits the bottom line, and what's it like to be a Disney princess? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 3rd of February. Good to have you with us. And we're going to start with the markets because it's been ugly today on Wall Street. The Dow dropped more than 300 points. Investors were selling anything risky and buying safety, namely in the form of Treasury bonds. Some economic data scared them, and they're still pulling their money out of emerging markets. But a huge motivator here is China. Numbers out this weekend show that its growth is slowing, and basically these days, China can't sneeze without everyone else catching a cold. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Trouble in emerging markets, currencies falling, interest rates rising, has been with us for a while, says Paul Ashworth at Capital Economics in Toronto.
We've had problems emerge in Turkey, in Argentina, and to a lesser extent, that's spread to other countries such as Venezuela, to South Africa, possibly even to Indonesia.
And today, news of a slowdown in manufacturing in China.
There's sort of a snowballing effect here that starts with China but ripples through to many of these emerging market countries.
Gary Thayer at Wells Fargo Advisors says this is impacting countries on other continents that supply raw materials for China to build houses and high-speed rail lines and iPhones.
A decade ago, it might have been more isolated to Asia, but now countries in South America and even South Africa.
So that's Chile for copper, Brazil and Australia for iron ore, several African countries that export hard-to-find metals. But Nicholas Lardy at the Peterson Institute for International Economics points out China's shift to a less export-oriented, more consumer-driven economy also has a positive side.
Incomes are rising in China. The diets are improving. China will still have a very large and growing demand for agricultural products. Services are rising, medical services, education.
And while a few U.S. heavy equipment makers might see a slowdown, Lardy says new exports to serve China's growing middle class should more than make up for the loss. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Cleveland is no stranger to losing things. Sorry, LeBron James fans. And now United Airlines is taking its talents elsewhere, too. Cleveland's not going to be a hub for the airline anymore. So what does that mean for a city when an airline pulls out of this kind of deal? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story.
Joe Roman, who heads the city's Chamber of Commerce, gives it his best shot.
Well, we're certainly disappointed, but I don't feel as if we left anything out on the table.
The airport itself got some upgrades. The city pulled back on some airport fees, and Roman says he got pledges from hundreds of local businesses to encourage their employees to fly United for work, and he says some of them adopted policies putting United's bottom line ahead of their own.
If the price of flying United, you know, falls within $300 or $400 of a competitor's ticket, fly United.
But it didn't work out. The airline says it was losing tens of millions of dollars a year on its operations there. The company's pulling 470 jobs from Cleveland. The worst-case scenario would be other businesses pick up and move. Here's Adi Tomer from the Brookings Institution.
The major example in recent memory was Chiquita.
Chiquita Brands, yes, the banana people. Delta pulled its hub out of Cincinnati's airport, and Chiquita moved its headquarters to Charlotte.
Because it offered them a city or a metropolitan area of similar size, but more expansive flight connections.
That's unlikely, says Michael Boyd, a consultant to the aviation industry.
Cleveland would do fine. They'll end up with about 35 to 40 nonstop destinations, and they won't have nonstops to Albany anymore. And all seven people every day who took the flight from Cleveland will be upset. But other than that, it'll be back to normal.
Other smaller cities, places the Cleveland hub serves, will get hurt more. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
And Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Yahoo, and LinkedIn released some of the first data about what they turn over to the government. Because of the company's deal with the Justice Department, the data is pretty general. But the AP is reporting that the U.S. collected data from thousands of Americans. Google's legal director said on the company's blog, "We still believe more transparency is needed." And all that read on the Wall Street boards today, we'll dig into it when we do the numbers. what you think of businesses, they're phenomenally practical. They survey the economic landscape and try to figure out how to make money. And that includes doing it at a time of rising income inequality. Companies sell to consumers at the top of the market and to ones closer to the bottom, but they're having a tough time in the middle. Nelson Schwartz wrote about this in today's New York Times, and he joins me now. Welcome to Marketplace.
Good to be here.
You know, there's this big conversation in Washington and nationally about inequality, but your story seems to show that businesses have moved beyond that, and they're just taking action.
Right. That's what I found really fascinating in reporting and in writing the story, is that I feel like whenever the topic of inequality comes up, it's so heated politically or ideologically between left and right. But when you talk to business people, they're not really interested in the politics. They're interested in making money and in, you know, growing their business, which is their job. There's nothing wrong with that. And they see close up what a lot of the politicians and pundits are still arguing about.
So give me an example of what that looks like.
There's a big restaurant company called Darden based in Florida. They own Olive Garden. They own Red Lobster. But they also own Capital Grille, which is more upscale. And Capital Grille is doing quite well, whereas Red Lobster and Olive Garden are having a very hard time. That's one example. If you look at casinos and gaming, the casinos in Las Vegas, like the Sands, which will appeal to, you know, higher rollers, they're doing very well. The regional casinos in places like Connecticut, upstate New York, Atlantic City are struggling. And this trend is being played out in industry after industry.
Traditionally, the wealthy are thought of as savers, and the working class, the middle class, are thought of as spenders, and that's where a lot of consumption comes from. Your story seems to contradict that. What are you hearing from economists and people you talk to?
You know, the key point is that since the recession, you know, the growth in consumption has occurred in the top 5% and to some extent the top 20%. But it's been very concentrated in those areas. So let's say you're a business and you want to gain new customers, you're going to appeal to the people who are spending more. I mean, it's as simple as that. The problem is with so much more money going to, the top 20%, less of that gets spent. It gets saved, which is not a bad thing. But in terms of economic growth, you don't get as high a level of growth than if you had income gains in that broad middle.
Tell me about the role of Amazon, e-retailers. They feel like they're replacing some of what a Sears used to do.
Right, right. What I found really interesting, again, in reporting this is you see this pattern in retailing, but as I mentioned in the story, you know, some of that is because of the rise of online retailing. I mean, JCPenney and Sears, and, you know, that is part of the story in retailing. However, you're seeing the same thing in restaurants and in hotels where the internet isn't really a factor. So that's why I'm really convinced this is not just a story of, you know, the internet disrupting a traditional market.
Spin this out. What do the choices look like for people in the middle if they want to buy stuff in 2-3 years?
I mean, I think people will still have plenty of options. I don't think, you know, all these stores will go out of business. And I think upscale stores will still have lower priced products. And what I worry about is what it says about economic growth in the long term. I mean, it's not even a question of fairness or left and right. Put that aside. You know, we want the economy to grow, and you want the broadest swath of the population doing well in order to have growth. It's just not as good for the country. I have a 6-month-old daughter. I mean, I want her to grow up in a time of prosperity and growing economy, not in more of a third world kind of have and have not situation.
Nelson Schwartz is an economics reporter for the New York Times. Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
I got to hop on a plane to L.A. last night and escape the cold and snow in New York, where I live. But there and lots of other places around the country, it is seriously cold. So maybe you're reaching for a hot mug of coffee. It's the second most traded commodity in the world, and it's getting cheaper, near record lows. Marketplace's caffeine reporter, Stacey Vanek Smith, looks at whether those market prices trickle down to us.
I get a coffee pretty much every day on my way to work.
Hi, could I get a 12-ounce latte with skim milk?
This morning ritual cost me about $4. The price of coffee is near record lows right now, less than half of what it was about 2 years ago. 2 years ago, when my latte cost about $4.
And this got me wondering, because it seems like when a commodity like coffee or chocolate or bread gets more expensive, the price at the store goes up, like when Starbucks jacked its prices up a couple of years ago. But when commodities get cheaper, the retail price never seems to go down. It feels like Murphy's Law of economics.
Well, I'm not sure that it's necessarily Murphy's Law.
Andrew Burns is an economist at the World Bank.
In a country like the United States, when you go to the store and you buy a loaf of bread, the cost of the wheat in that loaf of bread is relatively small.
That's because workers get paid a lot in the U.S., relatively, and rent is expensive. Burns says in countries where labor and rent are cheaper, the price of a commodity makes up a much bigger percentage of the price at the store.
In developing countries, when commodity prices are fluctuating, it's felt much more directly in the pocketbook of individuals.
Here in the U.S., the coffee beans in my latte, for example, only account for about 10% of the price, 40 cents of the $4. The rest of what I'm paying for is rent and labor. Still, 10% of a company's cost isn't nothing, so shouldn't I see at least a little savings? Turns out that depends on which kind of coffee we're talking about.
This is Wall Street Dark Roast, one of our favorites.
Gene Kakalin is the president of Highline Coffee. It makes single-serve coffee pods.
Interesting thing about the coffee market is that the commodity coffee market and specialty coffee market have a significant disparity in price. What you see on exchange right now is significantly lower than what we pay for coffee.
The beans Kakalin uses and the beans in my latte are specialty beans. The beans sold by the ton on commodities exchanges are used to make the coffee you might get at a diner or buy in the grocery store. Prices have gone down a little there.
This particular has a lot of stone fruit sweetness. I'm getting a really slight hint of milk chocolate with just a little bit of spice in the finish.
Matt Banbury is a roaster and manager for Joe Coffee, a chain of cafes. He's cupping. Using a spoon, Banbury samples coffee from dozens of porcelain cups, each containing a different blend of beans.
It's beautiful. It's really nice.
Banbury says for the specialty coffee market, there is something of a Murphy's Law going on. When commodity-grade beans get cheaper, the price of specialty beans won't necessarily drop. But when commodity beans get more expensive, all the beans get more expensive.
The level of quality that we're buying, it floats in its own sort of category. Though if the commodity price rises too high and there's a scarcity in commodity coffee, they will dip into specialty coffee, which makes things more expensive.
So when the price goes down, you guys might not see it, but when the price goes way up, you definitely see it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And my latte gets more expensive. Or maybe not. Cafes can't crank up the cost of a latte every week, even if bean prices are rising. Consumers are very sensitive to price hikes.
Espresso?
Especially before they've had their coffee. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, there are all sorts of currencies, including ones you use in prison.
It was a trip because people would be like carrying around like laundry bags full of ramen.
But first, let's do the numbers. Welcome to your first day on the job, Janet Yellen. The Dow Jones Industrial sliced off 2%, down 326 points to close at 15,372. The Nasdaq sheared off 2.6%, 106 points to finish at 3,996. And the S&P 500 slid 2.25%, or 40 points. It ended the day at 1741. Financial firms got hit hard. Goldman Sachs traded down 2.6%. Citigroup erased 2.33%. J.P. Morgan Chase withdrew nearly 2%. Morgan Stanley forfeited 1.8%. In Europe, major exchanges were down across the board. Japan's Nikkei gave back 2%. Bonds jumped as investors looked for a safe haven. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.57%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for December. A Senate Environment and Public Works Subcommittee holds a hearing to examine the safety and security of drinking water supplies following the Central West Virginia drinking water crisis. And Facebook was founded 10 years ago, allowing you to have thousands of friends that you never have to talk to or see. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
Thank you. This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. If you saw the Disney movie Frozen here in the U.S., then your Princess Anna sounded like the actress Kristen Bell, because she was voiced by Kristen Bell. But for the huge and expanding Chinese market, Princess Anna had the voice of our next guest. Her name's Janet Shea, and she's not a professional voice actor, though she's done some TV hosting. She came on to tell us about doing this unusual job. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So how did this happen?
I ask myself every single day. Well, so I've been working in Taiwan for the past 12 years, and I've been doing a travel show for the Discovery Channel. And basically, I've been practicing my Mandarin for the past, 12 years, and somebody from Disney called and said that they would love for us to be the voice of Anna because they thought that my personality is very similar to her. And our first reaction was, well, are you sure you want me to do this in Chinese? Because I do have an accented Mandarin. But it turned out fine. I mean, they gave me a voice coach and, every other word that I said probably a little bit wrong, they would just have me say that over and over again. And then when it actually came out, it was me as Anna, just with a slightly Taiwanese, Chinese, American accent.
Right. I mean, you're from Houston, Texas. Do you think the audiences who saw this, who spoke Mandarin, kind of clued in on that?
You know, I did ask around, and then I posted it on Facebook, and I was wondering, what do people hear? And they said that they don't hear the accent. Once you get into the character, you actually don't hear Janet, per se. I mean, you see Princess Anna, and you think this is just a Mandarin-speaking Princess Anna.
Can you make a living doing this?
You actually can. You know, I'm not a professional voice actor, but my coaches, for example, and, for the other voices of the other characters, they had, professionals come in and they got paid, some by case, some by hour. It really depends on how you negotiate the contract.
What's it like to voice a cartoon? I mean, physically, how do you do it?
So physically, you're just in a studio and you're not speaking with anybody else. So you're acting with yourself and the microphone. And I got a few tips. So for example, you're supposed to lift up your head. So the microphone is actually slightly above normal height. And that's so that you can project your voice. And then other than that, a few scenes where, you have to scream or whatnot, I'll actually physically step back and just scream my lungs out. But then you're standing a little bit further from the microphone.
Disney princesses are sort of an iconic thing. What's it like to be a part of that canon in a way?
When I was asked to be princess, any kind of princess, I was immediately just, jumping up and down on my bed, as princesses do. And yeah, when I have the DVDs, like, this is seriously, I'm going to buy an entire truck full of Frozen DVDs to pass out to everybody and anybody who wants one, just because it's so, so fun to be a part of the process.
Janet Shea did the Mandarin voiceover for Princess Anna in Frozen. Thank you so much.
No problem.
It costs about $29,000 a year to keep an inmate in federal prison. But it can also be expensive for the family. Really expensive. Amanda Aronchik has this story from Maine.
On any given day, you can turn on the news and hear something like this.
A Belfast man was sentenced to 4.5 years in federal prison today for his role in a cocaine ring in Waldo County.
About a drug conspiracy involving two young men up in northeastern Maine.
Prosecutors say the brothers were the link between drug dealers from New York and local dealers.
It's easy to ignore stories like this one until, of course, it happens to your son or nephew.
Here's this, lower middle class, working class family, our family.
The men who are arrested are Mike Hurley's nephews.
We're in Maine and they take two guys and stick them in Colorado. Don't look for compassion from these people.
Chris and Matt Hurley were sentenced to a federal prison camp for 30 and 56 months, respectively. Matt spent $10,000 on a lawyer, and Chris used a public defender. That's not a lot to spend on legal fees. Chris says he could have borrowed money from his large family.
They would have done it, but I didn't say, let's sell the house and fight this. I couldn't ask that.
But even without fancy lawyers, the costs went into the thousands. Chris lost his job and access to his bank account. everything had to be managed and paid for by his family back home. There's also no cash allowed inside prison, although some kind of alternative currency often develops, like trading cigarettes or stamps.
In some places, it's not stamps. In New Hampshire, it was ramen.
Ramen, as in the noodles. You can get your laundry done for, say, 2 ramen.
It was a trip because people would be like carrying around like laundry bags full of ramen.
This isn't legal, though, so as their months in the Colorado prison went on, when Matt or Chris wanted something from the commissary, shower shoes, dental floss, sweatpants, the family organized a fund.
What I was trying to avoid was making these guys beg or do stuff in prison that would get you money in prison.
Mike Hurley made sure that every month his nephews would have $50 each collected from the family. That adds up to about $2,500. But the biggest expense by far was the visits.
So, I mean, I kind of added up and thinking it was about $1,500 for the trip.
That's a lot for their grandmother, Roseanne Costello, who is still working full-time in her mid-70s.
I just needed to see them, to see they were okay. And they needed to see me. It was good.
Family members made the 2,000-mile trip 13 times, totaling roughly $20,000.
What we know from an analysis we did recently is that the average federal inmate is about 500 miles away from home.
Nancy Levine is the director of the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. She says the federal prison system has grown sevenfold in the past 30 years, so this affects a lot more people than you'd expect.
Virtually every American in this country knows somebody who's been touched by the criminal justice system.
Including this large, tight-knit family from Maine.
Everybody's been helpful to one degree or another. You know, we have some family members who are real cheapskates. We have other family members who also, like, feel like, hey, I didn't deal drugs. Why should I chip in?
Frankly, the day they got arrested taught them everything that they learned.
Their aunt, Jerry Holmes, says the brothers' time in federal prison has come at a great cost to everyone involved. When the family added up everything, they figure they've spent $60,000. And the money has been the least of it.
It doesn't heal anything. It doesn't teach you anything except for how to hoard your postage stamps.
In Belfast, Maine, I'm Amanda Aronchik for Marketplace.
There's video of the family in this story at our website, marketplace.org. This next story, just forget it. I'm out of here. Someone else do this show, man. Okay, no. But during the Super Bowl, a woman did that in an ad for GoDaddy. She quit her job, for real, on TV. Gwen, that's her name, is going to start her own puppet company. And there's been a whole spate of public job leaving recently. Why? I mean, is this some hopeful sign that the economy is improving? Sally Hership says more.
The government tracks how many people quit their jobs, but they don't have a category for public quitters, like people who announce their departure during the Super Bowl.
The Department of Labor does not track those numbers.
Kent Smetters teaches economics at Wharton. He says last November, almost 500,000 workers quit jobs in accommodation or food services. We're seeing higher quit rates from other jobs with low pay, too, like retail, what we'd expect to see as the economy recovers.
Those were kind of like holding jobs, you know, temporary jobs, and so they will quit those jobs if they feel like they can move up.
But public quitters, your need to vent on a large platform can come back to bite you. William Ward teaches social media at Syracuse's Newhouse School.
It's fun to watch on movies and on television and as entertainment, but it's really never a great career move.
The bottom line is it's just not fair to the other people.
Barbara Pachter is author of The Essentials of Business Etiquette.
You know, you're only presenting one side of the story. There's always two sides. I mean, people can publicly quit, and they can be a bad employee.
Which means future employers may be wary. But John Israel, a labor lawyer in New York, says Gwen in the Super Bowl ad was careful. She didn't even mention the name of the company she was leaving.
I suspect that there was a lot of consideration given not to make difficulties for her employer.
Or herself. Israel says public quitting can lead to lawsuits. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, I'm going to go ahead and assume that if you watched the Super Bowl last night, you ate something while doing it. Wings, nachos, whatever. Turns out Americans spend more than $1 billion a year on Super Bowl snacks alone. Our friends over at the website Deadspin put together a March Madness-style bracket to determine the best Super Bowl dip. 32 dips got voted down to a championship match of classic salsa versus guacamole. Congratulations, guacamole. You're the winner. Remember that when you're shopping for your billion-dollar spread next year, America. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace for American Public Media. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. See you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.